I allowed myself to change the title a little bit and extend the subject of the talk. As announced, the very first part will be about accretion flows, black hole accretion flows at quite low accretion mass transfer rates. But I will, in the second part, I will discuss implications of these properties, of the properties of such flows, to the issue of the AGN feedback. So I will start with discussing the efficiency of black hole accretion in the optically thin limit. And then in the second part, I will tell you what it means for the feedback. And finally, I will propose a way of implementing such prescriptions as we obtain for structure formation simulations. So let's start with the basic things. Why do we care about, why do we still care? Why do we care about black hole accretion flows? We care about them because black holes are very compact, and whenever something falls onto a compact object, it liberates plenty of gravitational energy. If this energy can be converted into radiative luminosity or mechanical luminosity, then such an object becomes extremely luminous. And we do believe that black hole accretion is involved in many of the most energetic phenomena in the universe, in particular X-ray binaries and also AGN. It is widely believed that every single galaxy contains a supermassive black hole in its center. To some extent, unfortunately, there is no one solution for a black hole accretion flow. I will briefly recap what has just been told. There are three fundamental modes of accretion. At the lowest accretion rates, we expect gas to have very low densities and very high temperatures. Such accretion flows are optically thin. Because they are optically thin, they do not cool efficiently, and this is why they are hot. So these are called advection-dominated accretion flows, and we believe this is what is behind the low hard state of X-ray binaries, what happens in most of the galaxies, in particular in the center of our own galaxy around the Sagittarius A star. At the intermediate accretion rates, we expect the disks to be thin. This is the celebrated Chagrin-Sunayev solution with optically thick disk, with optically thick gas at quite relatively low temperatures. And this is what we observe in high soft state of X-ray binaries, and this is what makes quasars so bright. And finally, once the critical Eddington accretion rate is exceeded, and when we talk about the highest accretion rates, then we expect that such accretion flows to become once again optically, geometrically thick, but they are at the same time optically thick, and funny things start going on, like photons may not have enough time to escape. And such supercritical models can explain some of the ULXs, but also other extreme phenomena. In this talk, I will focus on the transition from the optically thin regime to optically thick. At the lowest accretion rates, we believe that most of the accretion flows are described by an optically thin solution, and that they are radiatively inefficient. However, at some point, the densities of such solutions become so large that emission from Bremsstrahlung becomes essentially significant, and they can no longer satisfy the condition of a low radiative efficiency. And at some point, such solutions simply no longer exist, and one expects a transition into the lower branch of the optically thick S-curve of solutions. How this transition happens, this is this big question mark here. This has not been yet well studied, especially in numerical terms. So we expect some kind of a transition from this very hot and optically thin solution to a geometrically thin disk with low temperatures. And this is of interest because essentially every single galactic microquasars shows transitions from low hard state to the high soft state. And also, if we look at the population of galaxies, the spectrum of the accretion rates is essentially continuous, so many of AGN would actually fall into this regime as well. I want to mention that analytical and semi-analytical work has already been done, and this is an example of a work by Xie and Yuan, who essentially predicted the radiative efficiency of accretion flows in this intermediate regime. And this plot is showing that this radiative efficiency, so the amount of radiation generated per accreted gram of mass, increases with accretion rate, and this is expected because the higher the density, the larger is the efficiency of the Bremsstrahlung emission. But there is one extra degree of freedom that we should keep in mind, and this is the efficiency of electron heating. The hotter are the electrons in a given system for a given gas temperature, the larger is the efficiency of the cooling, because these are the electrons which emit photons. And here in this set of solutions, they are described by this fraction of dissipated energy going into the electrons, and you see that the higher the electron temperature, the larger is the radiative emission, as expected. So I decided to tackle this problem with numerical methods, so let me describe very briefly how one can simulate black hole accretion. This is, I always realized that this is essentially the simplest accretion flow problem that one can simulate. Plasma is fully ionized, so we care only about ideal MHD. However, because these are black hole accretion flows, one has to account properly for the curved space-time. One has to be able to follow, to track the radiative effects, one has to not only solve the equations for magnetohydrodynamics, but one has to also solve a radiative transfer in parallel, which will allow for following the interaction between gas and radiation. And finally, one has to keep track of the electrons as accurately as possible, because these are the electrons which determine the properties of the radiation. And finally, if someone is interested in spectra, electromagnetic spectra or images, then radiative post-processing will be required. And all these elements have to be put together into a multidimensional fluid dynamics solver, and the solver that I am using is called CORAL. It is a finite difference scheme which evolves radiation in an approximated way, evolution of radiation field coupled to equations of magnetohydrodynamics, ideal magnetohydrodynamics. Radiation provides cooling and it also provides pressure support. At the same time, radiation photons can be absorbed by the gas, which essentially makes the interaction complete. This approach is not frequency resolved. I do not follow radiation field as a function of frequency, but I do evolve number of photons, which allows for tracking of the characteristic temperature of radiation. I account for comptonization, synchrotron, and Bremsstrahlung radiative emission, radiative processes. The code is capable currently of evolving the electrons and ions independently. Can track Coulomb coupling properly and also can track non-thermal population of electrons. But these three elements for the purpose of the project that I will be describing in a moment were not used. And such a set of physics is essentially enough to study accretion flows at any accretion rate at any optical depth. And it was very tempting to start studying this transition regime. So this is a very brief description of the simulations that I perform. So instead of evolving the electrons independently from ions, for reasons that I would not like to go into during this talk, but I am happy to discuss them offline during the break. Instead of that, I prescribed the temperature of electrons using a fixed ratio of ion to electron temperatures, and the range of parameters I studied started at the ion to electron temperature ratio 10 down to 100, and 10 corresponds to the hottest electrons. Please think of this as a fixed temperature of gas which you then need to redistribute, which you need to distribute between ions and electrons, and electrons are always colder than ions, and the ratio tells us how far the two temperatures are apart. If they are close to each other, it means that electrons are quite hot for a given gas temperature. If they are far apart, it means that essentially electrons are for 100, they are two orders of magnitude colder than ions. Okay, so this is it. This is an example of evolution of one set of such simulations. This is gas density, this is temperature of the gas, and for one of the simulations here. The simulation itself is not interesting by itself, but it is interesting to see how the simulations compare with each other. And here is a set of three plots, and they correspond to relatively the same, more or less the same accretion rate of the order of 10 to minus 3 Eddington units. And they are different by different ratios of ion to electron temperatures. In this case, electrons are very cold, so they are not efficiently emitting photons because they are cold. In this case, they are quite hot, so the electron and ion temperatures are just one order of magnitude apart. So you see that there is a difference between them. Already at this particular accretion rate of 10 to minus 3 times Eddington, you see that the hotter are the electrons, and the more efficient is the radiative emission from electrons, the colder is the gas. So the temperature is the temperature of the gas, the mixture of electrons and ions. So this tells us, this gives us the idea of how efficient is the cooling. This solution becomes much colder, significantly colder than the one at the top, because there is significant radiative cooling. So what that means? That means that the structure of the flow changes, but it also means that there is radiation emitted. So you can expect that such a system will have luminosity much larger than the one at the top. For the one at the top, this is essentially the radiatively inefficient limit. This is what you expect an ADAF solution to look like. Very thick and very hot. This is essentially virial temperature. It can't get any hotter. When we increase the electron temperature, and the efficiency of radiative cooling, you see that the thickness of the disk goes down slightly. It does not yet collapse. It is not a Shakur-Ensign-Naive solution. And as I already mentioned, the temperature goes down, which essentially reflects the fact that the radiative losses are more and more important. So let me now put together all the 9 simulations which I performed. And the top panel shows the radiative efficiency, defined as the luminosity in radiation divided over by, normalized by the rest mass energy flux. So this is essentially this epsilon efficiency. The bottom panel shows the mechanical efficiency, but I will come back to this later. So there are 3 lines on the plot, and they correspond to different electron temperatures. And this is essentially kind of expected. So what we see, the larger is the accretion rate, is the higher is the efficiency in radiation. Okay, this is what was expected. The higher the densities, the larger, the more efficient is Bremsstrahlung emission, we expect larger and larger luminosities. And the other thing is essentially expected as well, that the hotter the electrons, the larger is the radiative emission. So let us focus, let's say, at this 10^-3, this 10^-3 Eddington accretion rates. And then we see that for the coldest electrons, the efficiency is essentially zero. It's definitely radiatively inefficient, but you can expect much higher for the electrons with the mid-temperature ratio. And finally, for the hottest electrons, the emissivity is the largest. Okay, so this is nice. One thing to keep in, to take away from this is that you can obtain efficiencies almost as high as Shakur-Ensign-Naive solution predicts. Shakur-Ensign-Naive predicts for a zero black hole spin, and this is a disclaimer that all these simulations assume zero black hole spin. Shakur-Ensign-Naive predicts efficiency of the order of 6%. And you see that even not for the most extreme electrons, you obtain efficiency in radiation of 2%. So this is a lot, right? This is essentially almost half of Shakur-Ensign-Naive emission. And this is possible still for a solution, for a disk, which is not geometrically thin. This is still a geometrically thick solution, and a disk which is optically thin. If you integrate optical depth for scattering across the disk, you would get 10^-2. So one takeaway point is that you do not need to be optically thick to get high radiative efficiencies. So this is somewhat consistent with the picture which was proposed a couple of years ago of so-called luminous hot accretion flows. But I would like to leave this behind, because the second part is more interesting and more relevant to the second part of my talk. So these are the kinetic efficiency. So you expect, when you have an accretion flow, you expect to get some radiation, some photons, and you expect that, you also expect essentially mechanical power. You expect winds to be generated by such an accretion flow. And you can estimate this kinetic luminosity by subtracting the total luminosity and the one that you obtain in radiation. And you find out that essentially independently of the mass accretion rate, as long as you are in this geometrically thick regime, you obtain efficiency of the order of 3, maybe 4% of the rest mass energy flux. It has been essentially a year or 2 or 3 ago, my collaborators and myself, we calculated this efficiency for the limit of totally radiatively inefficient accretion flows. And it was of the order of 3% for a non-rotating black hole. But now we can say that this essentially stays close to this value across the spectrum of accretion rates. Of course, this will probably change when the solutions collapse into Shakur-Ensign-Naive solution, but I was not able to track that for many reasons, so I'm just referring to this very top branch of the optically thin solutions. So this is the takeaway point, that we should expect the mechanical efficiency more or less of the order of 3% and not dependent on the actual accretion rate. Okay, so now what does that mean for the interaction of the supermassive black hole with the galaxy? So let me very briefly mention why we care about black hole feedback. And what black hole feedback means, essentially this is the effect that the supermassive black hole in the center of galaxy imposes on the galaxy itself. And this is possible that the very tiny, in terms of mass and in terms of volume, black hole affects the huge galaxy around. It is possible, once again, because of the compactness of the black hole. It is so compact that if we even drop not much gas onto the black hole, we can extract energies which will be very significant from the point of view of the galaxy itself. So there are some kind of smoking gun evidence, pieces of evidence for this interaction. One of them is the fact that that most massive galaxies do not show the expected star formation rates in their cores, and this can be done. The star formation rate can be suppressed if there is extra source of heating, and the only plausible explanation for this source of heating is essentially this, the heat coming from the supermassive black hole in the center. Also, we know that there is a relation between mass of the black hole and the velocity dispersion, which tells us that the galaxy as a whole knows about the black hole in the center. And finally, there's essentially kind of a direct evidence that the black holes, supermassive black holes in centers of clusters and galaxies pump plenty of mechanical energy into the surrounding, because we can observe cavities inflated by outflows. We can calculate the power which was necessary for inflate them, and we find out that these powers are essentially so huge that they must affect the galaxy as a whole. So let me now point out this, come back to this point of suppression of star formation. So to suppress the star formation, one has to heat the gas, which otherwise would simply cool down and collapse into stars. So this is a nice experiment made by my collaborator, Massimo Gaspari. He did it a few years ago. And this was to show what happens with a core of a galaxy if there is no heating, if there is no AGN feedback. So the dots show essentially the observed profiles of temperature as a function of radius from the center of a cluster, and the density as a function of radius as a function of distance from the center of the cluster. So these are the observed points, and it turns out that these profiles are pretty common. So it means that galaxies, clusters, must remain at such profiles essentially for billions of years, which means that they are kind of stationary. They are constantly, permanently maintained. So what he did, he started the simulation where with this dashed line, which more or less reflects the observed profiles, and then let it evolve using sophisticated methods of simulating clusters and cores of clusters. I will not go into detail, I don't know them. But what you see is that very quickly, within one, even half a billion years, the profiles depart very quickly from the initial one. So without any external heating, the temperature drops down very significantly and very quickly, and the density and gas becomes more and more concentrated at the center. This is not what is observed. All the cores essentially keep this type of profile for very long. So such experiments and observations allow to estimate the amount of heat which has to be deposited into a cluster of a galaxy to be able to sustain the observed profiles, to be able to suppress the star formation rate as observed. Okay, so this will be one of the constraints that I will use later. How do we get this heating? How do we get essentially the feedback? We get it because the supermassive black hole is being fed, because there's accretion on the supermassive black hole. So now let me comment very briefly how are the supermassive black holes fed. So it turns out that this is not a simple process. It's definitely not a spherical accretion. It's not a Bondi type accretion flow. It is not even as a simple, permanent, living forever accretion disk maybe to some extent we expect in X-ray binaries, where there's one well-defined donor which gives you the mass, which gives you the gas, and the gas simply forms an accretion flow. It's more complicated because there's no well-defined kind of reservoir of the mass. Instead, the gas which is near the center of a galaxy is affected by rotation. It rotates with respect to the center of the galaxy. It constantly cools, and it is turbulent. And not only it cools, but it at the same time is being heated by the luminosity, by the heat which is deposited by the supermassive black hole and the central accretion flow. So this is quite a complicated picture, and there's a nice set of three words to describe this type of mechanism, this scenario. It's called chaotic cold accretion. So let me very briefly describe how this Cauchy cold accretion works. It works in a kind of a loop, but of course this is a very simplified picture. If the cooling of a given gas in the core of a cluster is larger than the heating that this gas is obtaining from the central black hole, then you can expect that this gas will cool down. And it can be shown that such gas can be thermally unstable and it will cool down into, it will condense into clumps of cold gas. And these clumps will then slowly or not slowly interact with each other. Interactions will remove angular momentum and will essentially allow some of these clumps to get closer and closer to the center of the black hole. When they get closer, the volume that they becomes even smaller, so they interact even more often. And the result is that because of this effect, there is this kind of rain of clumps of cold gas falling down onto the central black hole, and probably these colors are supposed to show that. So the gas is actually raining down on the black hole, but it rains down in many clumps. It's not a single flow that you would expect in a simpler scenario. When it reaches the black hole, when such clump of gas reaches the black hole, you expect that essentially the output of the AGN is boosted up because now you have a larger accretion rate than you had before, which quickly deposits energy by dissipating this kinetic energy of the outflows in the thermalization region, and essentially this condensation, this raining stops. After a while, you can expect that the feeding of the black hole will terminate and you go back to the very beginning of that loop. So it is definitely nonlinear, quite a kind of complicated structure, but this is what is believed to happen in the centers of galaxies. Okay, so now before I go into actual numbers and the implications which I promised, let me briefly discuss once again the same picture using this kind of sketchy plot. The bottom part of that plot presents essentially what happens on the inflow side of the core of a galaxy. The top panel shows what happens on the outflow side of the same region. So as I just said, in this region, cold phase condensates. It interacts with each other. There are collisions of these cold clumps of gas, and this is where essentially the supply of the gas is being formed. And at the smallest scales of the order of thousands of gravitational radii, probably, these clumps finally form the actual accretion flow, and the accretion flow forms. And finally, we know that accretion flows produce outflows, so we can expect that outflows will be generated in this inner region, but there is still this innermost region, essentially, I don't know, maybe, okay, let's say inside ISCO, where we expect no outflows, because only gas can cross the horizon only one way. So there is no, the inner boundary is that there are just inflows, there are no outflows. So let me discuss now briefly what happens to the outflows. So this is, once again, at the horizon, very close to the horizon, you get only inflow, but just outside the horizon, you expect the accretion flow to produce outflows. And this is where outflows are produced. This is where outflows are actually also observed. So there is plenty of evidence for these ultra-fast outflows being ejected. What happens next? So in this accretion flow region, these outflows are generated and they freely propagate out. This is fine, but later on, once they leave this innermost region, they start to interact with the background gas. How do they interact with the background gas? Well, so they essentially push this gas outward. And you can show that if such outflows conserve energy, then essentially the accretion rate, the mass transfer rate, is increasing with time by the so-called entrainment factor, but at the same time they slow down very significantly. And finally, in the region of thermalization, they essentially stop down, they shock this gas and deposit all the energy into this medium. And this is how the actual heating goes on. So this is this type of the loop which I have just described. Okay, so now let me do some very basic math. So let's start with the, well, kind of fundamental energy balance, fundamental conservation of energy. So as I said, from the point of view of the core of the cluster, you want that core to be heated with a given well-defined power. And where does the power come from? It comes from the black hole, right? It comes from the accretion flow near the black hole. So this is reasonable to expect that if the black hole produces the same power, if the total core of the cluster wants to absorb the same power, it means that in between, essentially the luminosity of the system is the same. This is the kind of assumption of stationarity. Average over time, the flow of energy from the accretion flow from the black hole is essentially constant independent of radius. So this is what is provided, what has to be provided by the black hole. Well, how does black hole provide energy? By converting rest mass energy flux into energy, and with efficiency epsilon. For a quasar, for a thin accretion disk, this would be the 6% of Shakouin-Sunayev. But I have just proved that for as long as you are optically thin, and this is the most important regime for the feedback, because most of the galaxies, most of the AGNs spend their time in optically thin regime, this maintenance mode. This efficiency for zero black hole spin is of the order of 3%. Okay, so we have luminosity, we have epsilon, we immediately obtain the accretion rate, average accretion rate of the black hole, the rate at which the mass of the central supermassive black hole increases with time. This is a function of the temperature of the cluster, of the core, which scales with the mass of the cluster. So this will not be one robust number, but it will depend on the mass of the cluster of a galaxy, quite reasonable. And when you look at this number, this gives you, in the local universe, sub-Eddington accretion rates. So this is kind of a well sub-Eddington accretion rate. So this is kind of a consistency check, that the assumptions hold, the assumptions we predict hold. Okay, so this is about the increase of the black hole mass. It's already something and quite interesting. But then we can learn more. So it can be estimated from this whole theory of chaotic cold accretion. What can be estimated is the rate at which these cold clumps of gas approach the center of the system, center of the galaxy. This would be this cooling, or actually quenched cooling transfer rate. This is essentially what is being supplied into the innermost region. This is what is supplied to the outer edge of the accretion flow, which is at the center of the galaxy. Okay, and what we know? We know that the power of the system is carried by outflows. This is essentially the assumption. The radiative power is either negligible or does not couple with the gas. So we have these two expressions. There is a power of, there are outflows at the scale of accretion flow, where they are not yet interacting with the background gas. And there is also a region where they start to interact with the background gas. But let's focus first at the inner properties of the inner outflow. So we can combine the formula for the power with the constraint of the total luminosity. We can introduce the efficiencies which are required, which are known at the lowest horizon scales, and the efficiencies which are known at the largest scales from this chaotic cold accretion model. And you can finally subtract the inflow rate from the, we can subtract the horizon transfer rate from the inflow rate, and we can obtain the amount of the gas, the transfer rate of the gas leaving the accretion flow. So this is pretty fun, because when you actually simulate the accretion flow itself, you can't say what fraction of the gas which is reaching the outer edge of the disk actually makes it all the way through to the horizon, because the computations are always limited to the very innermost region. But if you couple constraints from the inner region with the large scale constraints, you can obtain this number, and this is pretty fun, because then you can show essentially that hardly anything reaches the black hole, kind of expected. And I will give you the number in a moment. But also combining this formula allows you to obtain the typical velocity, typical energetics of the outflows being emitted from the innermost region, 10 to 4 kilometers per second. These are exactly outflow. These are exactly the ultra-fast outflows that are being observed. And this can be considered another kind of consistency check. So what is this ratio of the gas reaching the horizon as a function of the gas being, as a function of the mass transfer rate being provided to the outer edge of the disk? It is of the order of 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 1, so which tells us that outflows are essential. They essentially contribute that the inflow, the horizon transfer rate is just of the order of few percent of what is being supplied. So please keep this in mind. Okay, and finally, there's this outer region of the outflow, where the outflows start to interact with the background gas, and this region can be parameterized by introducing this entrainment factor, which tells us how much larger is the accretion, is the outward transfer rate in the outflow, which can be translated, assuming energy conservation, into essentially the velocity damping. And finally, if one assumes that if one follows the observational constraints that the density in cores of clusters scale like 1 over r, then one can obtain this formula for the entrainment factor, which depends on essentially observed densities at a given radius and known quantities. And it can be shown that this entrainment factors are different for different phases, for hot phase, warm phase, and cold phase. This gives some coefficients that one can use or not. But This can be once again verified against observational constraints. This is, for example, this is a plot which shows our prediction of the velocity of this outflow in this entrainment region for a warm phase. And this is denoted by the cyan region or by the blue line. And this is compared to actual observed observations put together by Tombesi, which is marked by the red band. The bottom line from this is that very simple assumptions like we did give very reasonable reproduction of the observational constraints. So this is reassuring. The last two slides, maybe three. How can we incorporate this and why do we care about that? We care about that because people simulate structure formation. They simulate how the universe evolves. But this is what is typically done to account for the feedback, which must be there. If there's no feedback, if they don't put AGN feedback, they get too large cooling rates, too large star formation rates. So this is what is typically done. Power of the coming from the supermassive black hole is epsilon times m dot black hole times c squared. What is m dot black hole is epsilon, another epsilon times the Bondi accretion rate. And these two numbers are essentially taken out of the pockets. They are tuned so that the system actually looks like it is supposed to look. So these do not have physical meaning. And even if they, if you get constraints on them, then it is difficult to say what is the physical meaning of them because Bondi accretion flow does not take place. It is not how they are fed. So we propose, myself and Massimo, we propose, we think, a better way of doing that. And how to implement this feedback model depends on the resolution of the of simulations. So if one has a simulation of very low resolution, which essentially does not resolve this region of outflow at all, then essentially what has to be done, one has to essentially put the required luminosity into thermal energy as close to the center of a cluster as possible, and one can grow, one should grow the black hole with the this rate, which tells you how quickly the how quickly the supermassive black hole grows. If you have super high resolution, so that you can resolve essentially the Bondi radius, I'm not sure if this is possible, then you can use the information which we got about the inner region of the outflow, the region where the outflow does not outflows do not interact with the background gas. You have well-defined velocity, and once again the black hole mass growth rate. And once again, they scale up with the large-scale properties of the cluster or galaxy, which are very well constrained from the point of view of structure formation galaxies. And this is probably the most interesting part. Typical resolution currently is of the order of 1 kiloparsec. Once again, you grow the black hole with exactly the same rate, but you inject outflows, which account for this entrainment factor. So you define essentially the distance from your resolution. And depending on the resolution, the distance from the center, you get well-defined outflow accretion rates, outflow transfer rates, and velocity of these outflows. And using the formula that we provided gives you perfect constraint, perfectly satisfy the amount of the heating that is provided. This is the last slide. So recently, we started to be able to simulate the intermediate regime of optical depths, which is quite interesting because it allows to track the changes that the accretion flows undergo when transitioning from one regime to another. And the relief efficiency can reach a few percent of rest mass energy flux, even for optically thin accretion flows. Mechanical efficiency is relatively fixed and independent of the accretion rate. And taking this constraint and combining it with constraints on the large scale structure of cores of galaxies and clusters allowed us to construct probably the first principles based subgrid model for AGN feedback. And this is it. I appreciate your patience and attention. Thank you.
Hi, Oleg. In that slide where you had the sort of overview of the chaotic cold accretion and then the back reaction of the black hole, so it seemed that the length scale at which the clumps were transforming into an accretion flow was between 5 and 100 gravitational radii, and you mentioned 1,000 gravitational radii, that's what you actually said. What is actually determining that length scale? Because Massimo was trying to convince me that it was turtles all the way down. It was clumps all the way to the black hole.
So,
no angular momentum, no disk, no nothing.
You noticed that I said 1,000? He put 100 on the plot.
Uh-huh.
We had a kind of, we are still in a disagreement, but there's well-defined quantity which determines. This is the angular momentum of that clump of gas which is approaching the black hole. So the circularization radius of for a given clump of gas will tell you more or less where you expect the gas start forming the accretion flow. And I don't know what is this angular momentum, but I always kind of believed it's more towards one.
And neither does he, I assume.
Excuse me?
And neither does he.
So it can be actually very different for very different clumps. So probably there's no one good number.
So I was a little confused. So two things, really, I guess. One is, and they're related. So one is, I thought Sultan's argument tells us pretty convincingly that black holes gain their mass in luminous high M dot high efficiency phases. So I don't quite see how. So doesn't this completely violate this? I mean, you want to basically do things like M sigma relations, but not in those phases when we know that actually that must be happening. And then the second related question is, I thought the consensus these days was that you pretty much had to have two modes of feedback. So the so-called radio mode, so-called quasar mode, with quasars basically doing stopping star formation in within the host galaxies and the jets, which is maybe closer to this, but anyway, jets radio mode being what does things in clusters. But you were sort of conflating the two, and I was trying
I'm starting to forget the beginning of the question. Okay, so first thing is that, jets, you mentioned jets. Thank you for mentioning this. So essentially kind of a working assumption behind this model is that jets are collimated and do not interact efficiently with the gas. What interacts, what dissipates energy would be this quasi-spherical outflow, not the jet itself.
On what scale?
On what scales?
So the galaxy clusters, there's clear evidence that jets
interact. Okay, so on the scales of the cores, galaxies and clusters. About core. This is about cores of clusters. Okay, so jet is one important issue. Thank you for mentioning this. The second one was the Sultan argument. So Sultan argument tells us about the radiative efficiency of this. And this is a very good point. So this gives you constraints for the radiative efficiency. But another thing that one has to mention is that spin does not have to be zero. And if I did the experiments which I described in the first part of the talk for non-zero black hole spin, then I would get a higher radiative efficiency, I would get higher total efficiencies. Maybe this can kind of explain why Sultan argument gives something more closer to 10% instead of few percent.
But just to be clear, that would mean you're implying that when we look at, say, quasars today, 10-20% energy, you're saying that they're this.
So this is the assumption behind the model, that most of the feedback takes part in the radio mode, not in the quasar mode.
Well,
and I thought, there's no quasar mode. You mean what? There may be quasar mode. This is a kind of time average property of the center of the galaxy. But there may be quasar phases, but the assumption is that they are so short-lasting that they do not affect the mass too much and they do not deposit too much into the gas. Well, one thing, quasar essentially is not expected to produce too much mechanical outflow. It's supposed to produce plenty of radiation. And if radiation is decoupled from the gas, then this would not determine the evolution of the galaxy, right?
But yesterday I argued that quasar means unmechanical. Well, like
good points.
So
points.
Actually a question. So two points. The first is is related to Christian's point that, this is actually maintenance mode radio feedback mechanism. Of course, M sigma is set by the quasar mode, which is a short-lived mode, happens at high redshifts. But this is also very important to set the properties of galaxy cluster cores and elliptical galaxies. A related question is, I and a student have done simulations at cluster, I'm Pratik Sharma, by the way. So we've done galaxy cluster core simulations, putting kiloparsec and beyond scale simulations, and looked at the properties of the cold gas which condenses out of the ICM. And we have measured the angular momentum distribution of the cold gas, which condenses at kiloparsec scales and beyond. And you know, they have a chaotic sort of distribution of angular momenta. So if you like look at an instant, the circularization radius is pretty big. So that is, you form a big disk.
Yes, if but would they not interact within, inside 1 kiloparsec more to cancel the angular momentum?
That's correct. If they conserve angular momentum, they'll form big disks. Mm-hmm. But we also find that within like 1 giga year, which is sort of the relevant core timescale, the angular momentum distribution at low angular momenta is fairly stochastic or chaotic. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a lot of cancellation of angular momentum. Yes. So you'll form a very tiny disk, which is what is required.
Can you say how tiny? How tiny do you expect them to be?
Right. So, So it actually depends on your angular momentum PDF, and you know, mm-hmm. we can talk about it.
But
later.
What is interesting is that this does not depend on the size of the. It does not depend on the size of the accretion flow, because the efficiency will be determined by the very innermost region. So it's enough if you have an accretion flow extending to 100 RG, and this is the efficiency to get.
That's correct, but you have to get the gas from one, you know, large scale. So yes. it has to lose angular momentum
absolutely.
Sufficiently
yes.
fast somehow.
Yes. This is this collision phase, which I
but that is
have
really
little understanding of.
Okay, so I just wanted to point out observationally, you were equating the ultra-fast outflows with these outflows, but I think most of the convincing ones are in quasar luminosity sources like PDS 456.
Okay, good point, thank you.
Okay. That was actually going to be my question, that this gives you basically fast winds from a radiatively not very efficient flow, and we
yes.
actually, as Peter said, the really convincing ones are the PDS 456, which is a clearly Shigeru Sunyaev type disk.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, now you're talking about AGNs, but you do not tell us like what exactly the mass of black holes you put in your simulations.
Well, do you refer to the actual simulations I described in the first part or into this model?
No, in the first simulation is that when you show that when you do the simulation
okay.
from 10 to
the
minus 4.
That's a good point. So these simulations were made more thinking about the transition in the galactic microquasars, so the mass of the black hole set to 10, so it was low stellar mass black hole. But the assumption, working assumption is that as long as you are optically thin, then this is not, the mass does not scale free from the with respect to the mass of the black hole. This is a good point, but one should keep in mind that when entering this, touching this transition regime, and when the Bremsstrahlung becomes important, and when the temperature goes down, when it goes down to the regime where you would expect more complicated opacity than free, then yes, this should be an important thing. But these temperatures of these guys were still of the order of 10 to 8 Kelvin, so this should be fine. And should be self-similar between with respect to the mass of the black hole. But no longer. When they start to collapse and become more colder, then absolutely true. One should keep in mind the mass as well.
Okay, it's time for our coffee break, and I think we'll have lots of things to talk about during that time. So come back at 11.